Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the mission of the Military Times newspapers. But first, how did a washed-up 63-year-old retired JFK cargo worker allegedly make surveillance tapes of JFK Airport and tap into Muslim extremists in the Caribbean in a relatively short amount of time? That's what U.S. law enforcement officials are asking today. They say the alleged plot to bomb the airport was never close to being carried out, and that the investigation was cut short when police in Trinidad arrested one of the suspects in the case, forcing U.S. officials to arrest the airport worker, Russell DeFreitas, here in the U.S., and they say halting a valuable intelligence-gathering effort aimed at unraveling a network of Caribbean criminals and possible terrorists. Los Angeles Times reporter Josh Meyer joins us now. Josh, U.S. officials say Russell DeFreitas contacted the Islamic extremist group Jamaat al-Muslimin based in Trinidad. Who was he and who are they?
DeFreitas was a guy based in New York. The authorities are calling him a sad sack character. But he somehow hooked up with these guys from his home country of Guyana and tapped into what authorities say, is a international network of Islamic extremists, some of them related to this group, Jamaat al-Muslimin, and some that they believe might have just been more freelancers tied into an international network.
You write that the FBI and the CIA had been watching Jamaat al-Muslimin closely since the early 90s. Why?
They did launch a coup against the government of Trinidad and Tobago in 1990. Abu Bakr, the head of Jamaat al-Muslimin, and they took hostages, they took over the parliament. They were actually given amnesty afterward, but they've been causing trouble ever since.
The reason they wanted a coup is they wanted to replace the existing government with one based on Islamic law.
Right.
Do law enforcement officials believe the group has any connections to al-Qaeda or any terrorism outside of Trinidad and Tobago?
Well, they haven't seen any real overt connections. In fact, Jamaat al-Muslimin, if anything, and Abu Bakr have ties to Libya, of all countries. But there have been some alarming or at least concerning developments over the past couple of years, one of which was a guy named Adnan El-Shukr Juma, who is considered to be a top al-Qaeda operative. And he made a couple of trips to Trinidad and Guyana in 2001 before the 9/11 attacks. And they believe that he's come by there afterwards, too, partly to hide from authorities. And he's still on the loose, they believe, perhaps in Pakistan.
Well, you mentioned Russell DeFreitas, again, the fellow that people are calling a sad sack. People have gone to his neighborhood in New York, even in the Caribbean community, say they don't really know him. He was sort of selling books on the street. One of the things that officials are saying is how alarming it was, that how quickly he was able to hook up with other suspects.
One of the guys was a member of parliament in Guyana and also a mayor of a small town in Guyana and an imam or a religious leader, Abdul Qadir. And some of the other guys aren't as fleshed out in the complaint, but they still appear to be somewhat tied into an international network of extremists.
We know that there's a fourth suspect, Abdul Nur, who's still at large.
Right.
You mentioned Qadir, and then there's Karim Ibrahim, who seemed to be sort of a middleman or available as a middleman.
Right.
Tell us about the informant. We understand that he was a twice-convicted drug dealer who got inside the plot.
He apparently was very good at what he did. I mean, the alleged plotters said that he was a godsend and that he was sort of sent by Allah to help them with this plot. But he was a convicted drug dealer. Apparently, he was helping in this investigation in return for leniency in a criminal case and perhaps and for money as well.
Although we should say a court-appointed lawyer for Russell DeFreitas has said that the fact that this was a convicted drug dealer who was perhaps looking for a more lenient sentence, that he's already questioning the informant.
Well, that always happens in these cases, but, as the Fort Dix case from a few weeks ago shows, and this case shows as well, the FBI has an extensive network of informants, and they're using them very aggressively in these cases, and some authorities say that that's really the only way you can get inside these plots and watch them from the inside and know when to act and take them down, before something happens.
And, Josh, before we let you go, what do you make of the fact that, in fact, we have been hearing about these alleged plots that have been broken up? Some have said, even with inside the government, have said that perhaps U.S. authorities shouldn't herald them as much because in some ways they are the gang that can't shoot straight. But on the other hand, U.S. authorities point out, look, it is still troubling that people were able to get in contact with, Muslim groups as quickly as for instance, Russell DeFreitas did. What do you make of the fact that we're hearing about them with such frequency?
I think authorities are very concerned about these groups, and they're very aware people will raise questions about how serious these people were and how capable they were. But, the 9/11 plotters, I mean, if you had busted them before the 9/11 attacks, they could have been perceived even as some bumblers. I mean, they made some serious mistakes. They were caught, speeding and so on. And so, you can't tell until they become operational how capable they really are. At least that's what law enforcement officials say.
Josh Meyer, Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
From time to time, you may have heard us turn to reporters and editors from the Army Times to help us understand the intricacies of military life. The Army Times is one of several newspapers that comes under the umbrella of the Military Times. There's the Air Force Times, the Navy Times, the Marine Times. They cover all things military, everything from how to make the most of benefits and training to how to obtain a special assignment on Capitol Hill. And you may be surprised to find out the papers are independent and owned by civilians, the Gannett Company. So what is their mission? That's what Alia Malik wanted to find out, and she was surprised as well. Alia is a reporter for the Columbia Journalism Review. She was working on a story about desertions in the military when she ran across the Army Times in her research and got curious. She spent a few weeks at the paper's headquarters in Springfield, Virginia, and joins us now with what she found out. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, Robin. Thank you.
So just tell me about what your preconception was. What, you know, you had some surprises. Why? Because did you think that, oh, they must be run by the military?
Well, I think that's what everybody assumes. People even at my magazine assume that. But when I got down there, I tried to go with as few preconceived notions as possible. And in reality, I did find people that run the gamut of the political spectrum in terms of their support for the administration and support for the war. But I guess what is surprising, what would surprise people, is really how much of a spectrum that is. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who would be labeled, I think, probably progressives who work at the Military Times, as well as there are people who would be labeled conservatives, if those labels have any value.
Well, and what, I mean, give us your just broad brush, overall sense of who, you know, we know who they're owned by. Who are they writing for?
My impression is that the enlisted actually read it a lot, and that their leadership reads it when they sort of want to know what's going on in the ranks.
Yeah, and if you say they're writing for the military, mm-hmm. is it propaganda or is it journalism? Is it real journalism?
No, it's journalism. I don't mean that. I mean, in the same way that, for example, the Baltimore Sun is writing for Baltimore, mm-hmm. for people of Baltimore, you take the name of the community that you're covering, and they are a community.
Yeah, you write perhaps the world's largest gated community. And even though not, you know, the way the military is now, there are reservists, people aren't all on bases, mm-hmm. but they are still this across-the-country community.
The more I read the articles in the Military Times, and also I spent some time reading, you know, military chat rooms and military blogs, is how separate the military is kept from the rest of us in society. I felt like the separation was both them looking out and us looking in, sort of separate community.
Self-imposed in some ways.
Yeah. I did, you know, I should say the world's largest gated community analogy actually comes from the editor-in-chief of the paper, Tobias Nagel. And I asked him, is that gated from the inside or gated from the outside? And his answer kind of surprised me because I thought he would say gated from the outside, that we sort of, those of us who get to live our lives because of the service of other people, sort of, we don't want to have to think about that. But he said actually he thinks it's more gated from the inside.
Well, you opened your piece with the story of Gina Cavallaro, mm-hmm. a staff reporter from the Army Times. And she joins us now from Washington, D.C. Gina, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And it's quite a gripping opening. You were embedded with Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Infantry Regiment in Ramadi. It was your last day in Iraq, out on patrol with some of the troops, taking pictures of Iraqi kids, following them around. And walking with one specialist in particular, Francisco Martinez, when a sniper shot cracks the air. Tell us about that day.
It was a hot day in a kind of a quiet neighborhood. And I guess I had been on so many patrols and so had they. There's always a danger. But when that shot rang out, it sounded so close. I didn't know what to think. I just sort of turned around and I saw him lying there on the street. And I was incredulous. I couldn't believe it was him. He turned into a casualty.
You, by the way, I'm sorry because I know you'd become friends with him.
We had struck up a pretty good friendship. It's not unusual to strike up friendships with soldiers in the war zone. Any person who comes from the outside is a breath of fresh air, and he got to be the lucky one who got to walk with a reporter. He wasn't assigned as an escort. I think the commander just saw that we had struck up a conversation, and he just said, hey, Martina, stay with her, you know, hang out with her, stay with her.
Well, you wrote a personal essay in the Army Times about that day. Can you read just a little bit of that for us? This is right after Martinez has been shot. You help him into a Humvee, and you're riding with him back to the base.
Yes. Okay. Slumped in a fetal position in the seat, Martinez said he couldn't feel his legs. I took his right hand in mine and told him, in Spanish, to squeeze it, apriétame la mano, to look at me, mírame, to not fall asleep on me, no te me duermas, to keep breathing, respira, mi amor. Martinez kept responding, but said he was having trouble breathing. I stroked Martinez's jet-black hair and held his chin up so he could get a better air passage. His skin was damp with perspiration, and I ached to do more for him. The trip to the aid station seemed to take forever, but it probably took only about 7 minutes, and Martinez started to fade by the time we got there. I didn't want to see him die. I just didn't want to see him die.
But he did. And
he did.
Yeah,
he did. He died about an hour later after he had gotten evacuated. And I waited outside of the aid station. And even though they said he was going to be okay, that he had some severe damage, he did die. But I took one last picture of him on the stretcher as they were loading him into the ambulance to take him out to the helicopter, because I just thought, well, I'm going to show that to him when I see him at Walter Reed at the end of this week. Mm-hmm. I was on my way home, and I thought, well, so is he. So we'll meet up in Washington. That's where I live.
You got hundreds of emails and letters from soldiers. I guess I want to ask you, Gina, you know, we know there are many heroic reporters, you know, out with heroic troops. Many have sadly seen troops fall.
Yes.
Is there something you could do that was different because you write for Army Times?
I mean, it doesn't matter what newspaper you work for, but to the troops it matters. They thought it was really cool that I was with the Army Times because they consider that their newspaper. Mm. Say Army Times, they say, oh, okay.
Well, I think Gina's being maybe a little bit modest, but one of the things that is different if you read the Army Military Times papers is that these events and that community is not exotic. It's not made exotic. And sometimes if you're reading the national, you know, newspapers, and not to disparage their coverage at all, but sometimes, you know, it's such a new thing for them that they gleam onto things or they see things that, and they give things significance that maybe necessarily aren't. Mm. And I think it's a little bit easier, especially in the human interest stories, if you want to call them that.
I think you're right. I think one of the things that we do at the Military Times is, I know when I sit down to write a story, and even when I wrote this essay, I kept in mind who would be reading it, mm-hmm. and what would be important to them to know.
Well, by the way, some of the things the troops wrote to you, Gina, after your essay, they commended you, they comforted you. They wrote there was nothing like a woman's touch to comfort a man in his last hour. But when we come back, we want to ask, do you think Army Times reporters may be too close to the troops to write about the politics of war? Because it's the one thing the paper will not write about. We'll be back with Gina Cavallaro after a quick break here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now, and we're back with Gina Cavallaro, staff writer for the Army Times, and Alia Malik, who wrote about the Gannett-owned military newspapers in the Columbia Journalism Review. Gina, Alia writes that the papers don't cover politics. Now, we know the Army Times wrote about the Walter Reed scandal, so you don't avoid controversy. Why no political analysis? Do the troops react when you write something critical of the war?
Well, sometimes they will make comments, but yeah, I guess I'd say we don't cover politics, but we don't ignore politics either. Mm-hmm. It's a newsroom, after all. We're all journalists, and we comment on the day's politics in colorful terms probably just as much as anybody else in any other newsroom. But when it comes to writing our stories in the paper, I just don't think that politics is as important to our readership as your next pay raise is or what they've done to fix this quirky Velcro item on your uniform.
Well, and I want to jump in to say, you know, we've said you don't cover politics as in analysis of how the war's going or what the policy changes might be. But it's not as if you don't stay away from controversial topics. Your paper, I think it was Marine Times, actually, I think, mm-hmm. Broke the story about the inefficient armor.
Oh, yeah. That's great. It's just like the Walter Reed story. When we can get those stories out there and really have an impact on the individual soldier and the safety of those soldiers or the well-being of the soldiers, that's journalism at its best.
It's harder. It's more of a challenge. You know, it's a community that is built on hierarchy and rank and subordination. You know, it's much harder to whistleblow. It is much harder to, you know, say something that could be construed as, you know, insubordination. And I don't think journalists who cover a civilian community have the same challenges.
It's almost like covering a subculture. And I would say that politics, I mean, it might guide more of what goes on than they think, even though we don't directly write about it.
So it sounds as if the only thing that the papers stay away from is debate over whether or not the war should be fought and how it's going.
We have our editorial pages, and we also have a robust letter-writing community and people who write commentaries and opinions. So we've got about 3 pages dedicated to that, or 4 pages, I should say.
And don't forget, Robin, that in November, all 4 papers ran an editorial calling for Rumsfeld to go. I mean, you know, the way the editor-in-chief explained it to me, on some level it's irrelevant, you know, debating the causes of the war because the troops are going, and they are fighting there, and they are dying there, and their wives are getting left here, and they are coming back injured. You know, that's not going to change right now. I mean, when you read a story in, you know, the civilian media that says there's going to be a surge, well, you know, that's politics, but that, the way the Military Times is going to cover it, it's going to tell
the
community,
politics, what, right.
Yeah, how long are you going to stay there? Or how's your life going to change?
We understand, Gina, you're working on a story now about a battle that took place in Najaf on January 28th. That's the battle in which troops faced fighters from the Soldiers of Heaven, the cult group that wanted to put their own eye. I mean, how are you going to lay that out? What's your particular point of view on that?
We all read about this battle in January or in early February when it first happened, but I was just intrigued. First of all, it's rare to get a description of a battle like that from special operations troops and from Apache pilots, because they don't usually talk about what they do and what it looks like from where they sit flying around over a battle. And the battle was huge. It was about 800 enemy fighters, and there were hundreds dead when it was over. They were in a huge camp that no one knew was there. I mean, it's the more I learned about it, I realized, wow, I've really got to talk to more people who were there that day. So that should be coming out in the next couple of weeks.
But, you know, it's not just war stories. I mean, it couldn't be, you know, to fill the paper. You're also working on a piece about how soldiers apply for congressional fellowships, a coveted position on Capitol Hill. Can you throw out some of the other things that, you know, if you page through, like, you know, what would be some of the different stories I'd see?
In the paper every week, we have equipment stories, deployment stories. I think the stories the soldiers like the most are the stories that have to do with their promotion, new jobs, pay and benefits, things like that.
Well, and we're seeing on the website things like how to pick the best armor, how to help your kids cope. It sounds like, an O magazine for the, you know, the military combined with, you know, the tough stuff of war. And Alia, you were saying that one of the reasons, you know, you want to write this is you feel more people should be reading this who are outside of the military. Do you think this, as one of the senior managing editors says, this writing is sort of overlooked, not given the prominence it should?
No, definitely. You know, this country's now been in a conflict for 4 years, more soldiers are coming back alive because of advances in medical care, but seriously wounded. You know, this has, I think, is going to have a ripple effect in our entire society. I just don't know why you wouldn't turn to the people who do it best. And I should say it's not overlooked by, because I also did background reporting. I spoke to military correspondents at some of the big papers and people on the Hill, and they definitely look at the Military Times.
In fact, they steal from it.
I'm not going to say
if
that,
I may.
Yeah, I'm sure it's definitely a great cheat sheet. And I have to say, I would personally have been probably even more angry about it. But people sort of like accept that. I spoke to people. I asked every single reporter that I talked to about that at the Military Times, and they just sort of accept that as par for the course.
That people are going to take their scoops and not give them credit.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps now that more people know that this is not an advocacy newspaper that's published by the military, but one published by journalists about the military, and not just about the military. Again, Gina, Alia quotes you as saying, we're not covering the war, we're covering them. And by them, you mean what?
The troops. It's hard to describe being over in Iraq with the troops. You're always worried that someone you just met is going to get hurt or killed the next day. And I hate to say it, it happens. We all, at least a few of us anyway, we scan the casualty lists every day. And sometimes we see a name we know, and we just sit there and quietly nod and say, okay, well, you know, they're at war. I hope they come home soon.
That does make you markedly different from the reporters, many of whom, you know, don't get to spend as much time with the troops. Gina Cavallaro, staff reporter for the Army Times. Alia Malik reports for the Columbia Journalism Review. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure.
And to read more on this story, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Well, still ahead today, Scotland's Billy Connolly will be back right after the news, here and now. Support. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Still to come, the world's best-selling comedian. But first, have you ever wondered why the aisles of supermarkets are so long, or why supermarkets are even set up the way they are? Those are topics that Marion Nestle, a professor of nutrition at New York University and a longtime critic of the food industry, takes on in her book, What to Eat, which is now out in paperback. We spoke with her when the book first came out and began with that question, just why are those aisles so long?
Well, you have to realize that although supermarkets perform a tremendous public service and you can do all that one-stop shopping, they really are a business after all, and they're not social service agencies. And rule number one of supermarkets is that the more products you look at, the more you buy. So the object of the game is to make those aisles long so you're exposed to as many products as you can possibly see.
And so many products. You write in this very large book to cover all of this, an astonishing 320,000 edible products are for sale in the U.S., and the average supermarket might display as many as 40,000?
Yeah, at least. A big supermarket.
In fact, you say there's too much food available in the U.S.
Well, that has to do with calories. The American food supply has 3,900 calories a day available for every man, woman, and child in the country, and that's roughly twice the average need. That 3,900 is what's produced in the country, less exports, plus imports, and it's not really what people are eating. It's just what's available. And if you're a food company, you either have to get people to eat your food instead of somebody else's, or you have to get people to eat more in general. And it's not that food companies are sitting around a table saying, how can we make Americans fat? They're sitting around a table saying, how on earth are we going to sell our product in the middle of this marketplace in which there's so many products to compete with?
Well, let's talk about some of the ways that they do sell that product. As you write, supermarkets, they're businesses, they're set up to maximize food sales. You recommend, for instance, if people are, you know, are trying to cut back and trying to eat better, just stay on the edges. What do you mean by that?
Well, stay on the perimeter of the store because all supermarkets are pretty much arranged the same way. The fresh foods, the foods that you have to take home and cook, are invariably on the perimeter. And that's for two reasons. One, because you have to walk to get there so you see products. And the other is because it's easier to stock.
Within the body, then, of the supermarkets are the more processed foods.
Yes, the minute you get into the center aisles, you're in processed food territory. And by processed, I mean foods that really don't resemble the original foods that they came from very much. They've had salt and sugar and fat added that make them overall less nutritious.
Right. A couple of the points that you make about how food's sold, the high-cost foods are the ones that are at eye level. Supermarket products are to the right of brand name products so that your eye will naturally travel right and see those as well. I mean, there's a lot of tricks to the trade.
There are, and there's also money involved because companies pay the markets in order to place their products on the shelves, and they pay more to place their products on shelves in attractive places. And the most attractive places where you're most likely to see them are at eye level in the ends of the aisles and at the cash registers. Expensive real estate.
You know, while we're talking about marketing, I just want to take a second and talk about the marketing to children, because you write in this book and also in the New England Journal of Medicine about the how the food industry is trying to expand its reach by marketing to kids. A lot of people have said that how much that contributes to the childhood obesity problem, but you go so far as to say that marketers are undermining parenting. How so?
Well, if a marketer is marketing a specific food to your kid and you're not aware of that marketing, you only see it when your child is having a tantrum in a supermarket or is pestering you like mad to buy something. And what troubles me about it is that it's deliberate. It's deliberately trying to get kids to do three things. One, recognize brands. Two, pester their parents for those brands. And three, come to believe that foods with cartoons on them that come in packages that have toys that are in funny shapes and colors are what they're supposed to be eating, not those boring foods that their parents are eating.
Right.
And so in that sense, it undermines parental authority around food because it convinces kids that they know more about what they're supposed to eat than their parents do.
Right. It's like the in-joke between them and their friends, you know, the marketers of a cereal.
Exactly.
Right. How far would you go? I mean, you talk a lot about SpongeBob and how, you know, he's used to sell to kids. Would you ban cartoon characters?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you see a cartoon character on a food, you know that that food is being marketed directly to your children. And I don't think marketers should be doing that. So my extreme position is marketers shouldn't be marketing to kids at all.
Well, not anything. But tell us more about that because, you know, why? What? Tell us about some of the things that do get marketed. For instance, you talk about juices. As you write, they have sugars, but they've got nutrients as well. But what about juice drinks?
Juice drinks usually have less juice and more sugar water. I mean, they're basically a soft drink in disguise.
You call them liquid candy.
Well, they are. They have enough sugars in them and not enough nutrients to qualify as anything other than candy. And I think once you start thinking about soft drinks as candy and sugared cereals as low-fat cookies, you begin to question whether those are really the right things to give your kids for breakfast or even lunch.
How do you keep kids from... You know, they're so assaulted with the advertising. The candy's right at their eye level. You know, they now have these candy-free aisles, you know, the checkout aisles. But how do you keep kids from, you know, thinking that that box of cocoa, whatever it is their friend?
Well, first of all, you teach them how to cook. So you teach them what real foods taste like. You teach them where food comes from and what the food system is about. You teach them critical thinking so they can recognize an advertisement when they see one, and you don't have those foods in the house.
Yeah. Well, back to foods for everybody. I love your suggestion that fast food places in particular, there'd be a push towards half portions, you know, that you can pay less and, you know, get less. But that goes back to... You know, you're thinking that where places make their money is when you pay more for a lot.
Well, you pay more for a lot because the cost of basic food ingredients is low compared to the labor and the advertising and the packaging and the other things that go with it. And that has to do with federal policies about food. Our federal policies were set up so that food would be very cheap, and cheap food. It's hard to argue against cheap food. We actually have the cheapest food supply in the world. But cheap food these days has a health price, and that is one of the things that encourages people to eat more is when the food doesn't cost very much. And so it encourages marketers to make bigger portions. We've now gotten used to bigger portions. And guess what? Bigger portions have more calories.
Right. Marion Nessel, and by the way, your name is spelled, I think, ironically, Nestle.
No relation.
What's the one thing you'd want to see supermarkets do that would be better for Americans?
How about putting healthy foods in, or the healthiest foods in the places that get maximum attention?
Like where would that be?
At eye level, at the ends of the aisles, and at the cash registers. How about piles of carrots at the cash registers?
Not in our lifetime.
Oh, you never know.
Marion, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Marion Nessel's book, What to Eat, is now out in paperback, and since we spoke with her, the restaurant chain TGI Fridays has offered half-portion meals. Well, still to come today, half-portion meal? Scotland's Billy Connolly says Americans eat like horses at a trough. You're listening to Here and Now. Do you have a favorite quote? How about a favorite quote from a young author? That might be harder, and if it is, you're not alone. When Dwight Garner, senior editor of the New York Times Book Review, read the new Yale Book of Quotations, edited by Fred Shapiro, Garner found it lacking in literary nuggets from young writers, so he asked readers to submit some of their favorite quotes, and he was surprised by the response he got.
Well, you know, I asked readers for literary quotations from favorite books, fiction and nonfiction, from writers born after 1950. And, you know, and I got some, but a lot of what I got also was sort of bumper sticker slogans. You know, one was bark less, wag more. The other one was the secret to happiness is lower your expectations. You know, fun, but not really what I was looking for. Someone sent in, you know, John Belushi from Animal House saying, over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we say it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no.
Well, what about those that did fit your category?
You know, I was looking for things from Jonathan Franzen, Ann Patchett, Rick Moody, Dave Eggers, younger writers, and I did get some nice ones. I'll preface this by saying that I think the most famous line from a novel published in the last 10 years or so is probably from Chuck Palahniuk's novel Fight Club. And the quote is, the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club.
Well, give us some of the quotes you got from readers that were from the authors that you expected them to mention.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan Franzen, someone sent me a line from an essay of his. And the line is, the first lesson reading teaches is how to be alone, which is kind of a nice line. And another line from Jonathan Franzen's novel, The Corrections, is, better not to leave here than to have to come back, talking about a small town. A funny line from Arundhati Roy's novel, The God of Small Things, and that quote is, she viewed ethnic cleansing, famine, and genocide as direct threats to her furniture.
Who was the most quoted?
Probably Dave Eggers and Jonathan Safran Foer. Clearly, they have readers who are reading this stuff closely and clearly getting something out of it.
Jonathan Safran Foer has been a frequent guest here. We think he does have a clever way with words.
He does, and there's something almost Kurt Vonnegutish, something sort of a little gleam in the eye of his prose. That, you know, some of the lines people sent from his novels are, "Being with her made my brain quiet." Was one. Another is, from space, astronauts can see people making love as tiny specks of light. Mm-hmm. Things like that, sort of small, mini profundities.
Is that Everything is Illuminated?
Yeah.
How about women? Were there women writers born after 1950 that people quoted?
There were. I got a nice quote from Ann Patchett, her novel, The Patron Saint of Liars, and the quote is, she could leave her husband, but not his car. So I got a few J.K. Rowling quotes, Harry Potter quotes. Not so many from nonfiction books, but one or two nice ones. The writer Rory Stewart wrote a book called The Places in Between, which is lovely. And his quote, there was a combat photographer in Afghanistan who was asked why he didn't carry a zoom lens. And the combat photographer responded, I am the zoom,
which
is kind of nice.
Well, your search started because you didn't see enough of these quotes in the Yale Book of Quotations.
You know, it's a great book, and I recommend it. And he does a particularly great job of giving us quotes from young musicians. I mean, Tupac Shakur is in there, and P. Diddy, and Alanis Morissette, and Gwen Stefani. But I'm reading these quotes from them. I mean, Gwen Stefani, don't speak, I know what you're saying, and wondering where are the younger writers.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think over time, these books will filter into the culture a bit more, and we'll start to remember lines from them. I just think it takes time.
Do you think it's also true that they just don't hold up?
I don't think that's true. I really don't. I think some of these writers are just superb, and I think some of these novels will still be read in 20, 40, 100 years.
What do you take away from this overall? I mean, was this depressing for you that you didn't get as many as you thought you might, that they weren't wider? And actually, with that in mind, who do you think that we're leaving out? Who do you think we're forgetting when it comes to young authors?
Well, first of all, let me say, I think people had a lot of fun doing this, even though the conversation kind of went off the rails. It went off the rails in funny and interesting ways, so I like that about it. I do think that there are a lot of younger writers who I was surprised that we didn't get anything from. I mean, Chang Rae Lee is such a terrific writer, and Gary Steingart, we got nothing from his work. Elizabeth Gilbert, the nonfiction writer who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, which is such a terrific book. You know, there are just dozens of writers out there, and people seem to focus. I mean, Eggers and Safran Foer really seem to be the writers that the quotations coalesced around.
We should expand our thinking when it comes to the young writers.
Yep.
Dwight Garner of the New York Times Book Review, in a recent column, he asked readers for quotes from young writers to fill a gap in the new Yale Book of Quotations. And we throw that challenge out to you as well now. If you have some, send them on. We'll forward them to Dwight. Dwight, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, and I should mention you can send those quotes to letters@here-now.org. Billy Connolly's next, Here and Now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. We're pretty sure you've heard Billy Connolly, even if you didn't know it at the time. You'll recognize him from the film Mrs. Brown alongside Judi Dench, or from one of his many cameo roles in Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Over here?
That's the two-headed cobra.
Well spotted.
Is that a he or a she?
I've no idea. Didn't think it polite to ask.
From the 80s sitcom Head of the Class, or here he is commenting in his usual obscenity-laced way on his starring role as the pirate Billy Bones in the Muppet film Treasure Island.
I'm a huge film star, you probably know that. And, but you have to hurry to the movies because I usually die in the first 15 minutes. So, I'm the only guy I know who died in a Muppet movie.
Huh, I don't think I've ever heard the Muppets in the same sentence as the F word. And here's a warning, there are many more to come, because Billy Connolly is one of the world's best-selling comedians, and his complete irreverence is one reason why. The Scottish comedian has been in more than 50 films and TV shows since the 70s. He's sold out programs through Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and the U.S. His stories cover everything from a circus visiting his home city of Glasgow to growing older in the new millennium.
Here, now if I do old stuff, you... and tell me, right? If you smell urine off of me, or the worst one of all, if my tongue comes out when the spoon's only halfway to my face.
Critics liken Billy Connolly to George Carlin, credit him with inspiring Eddie Izzard. He's now touring the U.S., and he joins us from the Argo Network in New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much indeed.
At this point, I'm wondering if you're thinking after that long introduction, wow, I'd better be good.
So I don't care. I don't sweat about that stuff anymore because there's nothing you can do about it. The least you can do is be light.
Did you sweat it at one time?
Yeah, I used to think it was kind of expected of me to perform all the time. And I mean, it's kind of a stupid thing to think, but it all works out in the end. It's lovely.
Life seems to have changed. You were a welder's assistant in Glasgow before you got in comedy. What was the break? Were you just welding and knocking them dead?
Yeah. No, I was a welder in the shipyards, and it was great fun. And in my spare time, I played the banjo and sang folk music in the local sort of folk clubs, coffee houses and bars and things. And I was always like introducing my stuff in a funny way, because most of that banjo stuff is, you know, it's either about a guy killing his girlfriend, or it's about chicken pie, or trying to catch raccoons. It's kind of banal lyrics most of the time. So I would be funny about it. And it just happened. I just got funnier and better, and it overtook the music. And lo and behold, I was a comedian.
And now a comedian in the U.S. Let's hear a little bit from your Too Old to Die Young tour. This is on What Americans Eat at the Movies.
My advice to you, if you want to lose a bit of weight, don't eat anything that comes in a bucket. Buckets are the kitchen utensils of the farmyard. There's nothing more discouraging than sitting waiting for your movie to come, or somebody comes in with a big arm full of stuff. Do you want the large bucket, sir, or the family trough?
That's from the Billy Connolly Live in New York DVD. Billy Connolly, I'm listening to you. You're knocking yourself out here.
I thought it was... I did it right after I had been to see a movie in New York, and I haven't done it since. So I found it quite funny.
Well, you know, and I'm wondering, so that's obviously something that you tailored to New York. Would that go over in Britain if you...
Oh, yeah. They're the same. Yeah, they behave like farm animals at the movies. They're the same thing. And I went to the movies last week, and the person about four rows away, I don't know what they were eating, but it was in crinkly paper, and it was driving me insane. And I was scared to do anything about it in case they beat me up, but it has spoiled many a night at the movies. I mean, if you did that in a theatre, they'd throw you out.
In a Broadway theatre?
At the opera, if you did it at ballet or a straight play anywhere in the world, they'd say, excuse me, do you keep the noise down a little? But people seem to think it's okay at the movies.
What are you trying to do with the act, and especially through the use of the, well, the F word? I mean, it seems like, could you do it without it?
Oh, yeah. I just like doing it. I don't have a good reason for it at all. It's a kind of music, you know. It behaves like a comma or an exclamation mark. It has many functions. It has good rhythm, you know. And I just use it because I like doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm not on any kind of crusade to make everybody do it. It's just profanity, and it's rather pleasant, and it separates the wheat from the chaff. It irritates people I don't want to be in the same room as anyway, you know, so if they stay away, that's delightful.
What about your act? What about you is Scottish? I mean, obviously, your accent, your speech, but is there something else that makes you so profoundly more Scottish and different than, you know, a Robin Williams? Who, you know, is there something... Where's the Scottish part?
What, do you think he's Scottish?
No. Decidedly not.
I should
not
go around saying I'm more Scottish than Robin Williams.
No,
God, I haven't achieved much, have I? I don't look upon myself as some kind of super Scot, you know. Although I think Sean Connery does, because he's a Scottish nationalist politically, so he's kind of joined at the hip to the whole Scottish sort of thing. But I just happen to be Scottish, And I don't think it makes me much different from anybody else. I think that's what separates me from nationalists and people like that. They think they're sort of imbued with certain qualities because they happen to be Scottish. Well, I don't think so.
Hmm. Well, and by the way, we should tell people there is a move in Scotland to separate from Britain, a nationalist move, which got a little bit of head of steam recently, right, with a vote
yes,
in Parliament.
Yes, it did. Yep. Mm-hmm. I've always been against that.
Because
I'm not a nationalist, and I think it's time to get together in the world. You know, I don't think it's time to separate.
You're okay with the Queen?
Well, that's okay by me. Yeah. I was talking to Eric Idle about that whole Queen thing because I got quite friendly with some of the royals for a few years there, and I was going to dinner and stuff like that. Hmm. And a lot of the press attacked me for it because of my background and all that. That I shouldn't be doing that. And I'm not a monarchist, I never was, you know, but I don't believe in dragging people out and shooting them either. And I was talking to Eric Idle about it, and he came up with the best one. He said, I think we should set them free, you know, you know, like wild animals, put them back in nature.
Would they survive?
Oh, they'd survive. They're loaded. I would like to see them being set free myself, you know. I think they'd be much, much happier. It's a rotten job, I would imagine.
Billy Connolly, appearing, as we said, on tour. We'll let you know at our website, here-now.org, where you can find him around the country. But also we should say your newest film, Good Sharma. Just can you synopsize your role in that film? Because I'm looking at your list. You were a domesticated zombie in the movie Fido. You were
yes.
in the second Garfield movie. So what are we to expect in Good Sharma?
Oh, I'm a missionary, a Christian missionary, who doesn't believe in Christianity anymore, but who rather likes Hinduism and Buddhism. He's something of a hippie. But I met the woman who wrote and produced it, and she was telling me that the Indian guy who was part of the money for it has run away with the film. So I don't think it'll ever see the light of day. But that's never happened to me before. But it was nice being in India, and I got my money, so I don't really particularly care.
Billy Connolly may or may not be appearing in the movie Good Sharma.
Oh, I'm in it, but whether you'll see it or not, it's a different story.
For more on his national tour, again, go to our website, here-now.org. Billy Connolly, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for giving me your time.
And with Billy Connolly on the banjo, which seems the safest way to present him, Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Oh, Cripple Creek's by Cripple Creek's deep. I'm going to reach Cripple Creek before I sleep. Roll them britches up to my knees. Go down Cripple Creek as I please. Go down Cripple Creek, going on a run. Go down Cripple Creek, have a little fun. Go down Cripple Creek, going in the world.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.